Revenue Chat episode 138. The Dream Business community wants to help you with your career and business. Are you ready for accelerated success? Check it out. The Dream Business community at tonyduroso.com/community.
This is Revenue Chat Radio with your host, Tony D'Urso, interviewing successful entrepreneurs and giving you actionable advice and insights. Let's rev it up.
Hello again, and welcome to this episode of Revenue Chat. I'm your host, Tony D'Urso. In our last episode, 137, Mia Mohsen Zia provides a wealth of information and insightful lessons learned, which made him the number one Pakistani marketing and self-publishing expert. From mega hit books to voluminous testimonials and accolades from the entertainment worlds in the US and Britain, Mia shows us how to nail it on marketing and getting our own book produced and on its way to a bestseller. Learn from a master at marketing and self-publishing. You'll love this interview. Note, you can catch every episode of Revenue Chat on my mobile app. Just go to tonyduroso.com/mobile from your Android or iPhone. And once it loads, past episodes of Revenue Chat will automatically appear in column 2. Column 1 is my other weekly high-profile show that focuses on highlighting stars, greats, and game changers called The Spotlight with Tony D'Urso. Just go to tonyduroso.com/mobile from your Android or iPhone. All right. Today we set the stage for Revenue Chat with Michael Kimmelman, how to restart your life and succeed. Michael Kimmelman is a dynamic speaker, best-selling author, and executive coach with a diverse background and inspiring, insightful lessons on overcoming personal and professional challenges. From global CEOs to at-risk and formerly incarcerated youth in his hometown, Michael's mission is to share these lessons and inspire people to be the best version of themselves. Formerly an associate at Sullivan & Cromwell, he was the founder and managing partner of Incremental Capital, a New York-based hedge fund. He's currently a real estate investor and serial entrepreneur, launching new ventures in the consumer and fintech spaces. All right, Revenue Crew, let's rev it up. Get ready for Michael to tell us how to restart your life and succeed. Here we go. Hello, Michael. How are you?
I'm great, Tony. Thank you.
Michael, such a pleasure to have you. And I want to thank you so much for taking the time to hang out with us on Revenue Chat. This is very cool.
Very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And now today we're going to talk about how to restart your life and succeed. And I know you've got some really good things to tell us. But first things first, Michael, I'd love to know, how did it all start for you?
It all started way back in Southern California. I actually grew up in the San Fernando Valley, went east for college, flip-flopped back to the West Coast for law school at USC, and then took a job back on the East Coast with one of the bigger law firms, Sullivan & Cromwell, and was a lawyer for, I don't know, it felt like 18 minutes. It was probably about 3 years, and didn't really enjoy being a lawyer, as I'd say one or two other people who have gone through that experience can probably say the same. And ended up then, this was the late 90s, and there were a lot of people around me who were doing some pretty exciting things in technology, doing some very interesting things in finance, and figured that would be a better fit for me. So I lateraled over to finance, became a trader, eventually became a portfolio manager, worked for several firms on Wall Street and in New York, and then eventually ended up starting my own firm right around 2007. 2007 into 2008 was probably the exact wrong time to start a firm, as the as the financial world sort of started to burn and collapsed, and we managed to actually do quite well during that chaos and put up some pretty good numbers and grew our firm from pure startup to about $250 million in assets. We had about 50 people working for us, and we're doing quite well. And then in late November of 2009, the FBI showed up at my door, and everything went from what was perceived as great and terrific to a complete wipeout in a matter of seconds. And the next 5 or 6 years, we're sort of dealing with that complete wipeout.
That's astounding. FBI at your door. That's like right out of a movie. What happened?
It was. And I think you know, as a lawyer and as a guy who had seen plenty of good De Niro movies and Pacino movies, you sort of think, you know, you'll be a tough guy or somebody who went to law school. They go over this scenario and whatnot. And I opened the door. It was, as I say in the book, it was kind of like a car and you keep pumping the accelerator and you can't get your brain to start. It was just pure disbelief. I wasn't even aware that, you know, obviously I was a target of anything and didn't understand why they were at my door and asked, you know, a few questions. Didn't really get any answers. They were very closed mouthed other than, you know, let us come inside and we'll talk about it. But if you don't talk about it, you're probably not going to see your kids for about 10 years. So it would be in my best interest to speak. And I knew at least that much, that you don't speak to law enforcement in that type of situation, because that's how a lot of cases get sewn up. If you're a prosecutor or an agent, it can become a case of a false statement. They can say you omitted some information when they asked you a question, and it really becomes their word against yours. So most counsel will tell you in that type of situation, just don't say anything or ask for a lawyer. But I couldn't help but ask for a few questions, such as, you know, why are you here? Why are you in my house? Why is there a German Shepherd running around and an FBI SWAT team going through my house? And what they did tell me was that it was for securities fraud, and they wouldn't give me any other information other than that. And I actually thought it was for something completely different than it ended up being to some degree. I thought it was a stock called Hilton Hotels that I had traded that I knew my partner had told me about. And he had worked for a gentleman named Raj Rajaratnam, who ran a very big fund called Galleon. And Raj had been arrested a couple weeks before. And I, being a lawyer, had pulled the criminal complaint off the website of the Justice Department and saw that my partner had worked for Raj during the exact time period that Raj was, you know, under investigation, and that one of these stocks, Hilton Hotels, was what they were looking at Raj for. And I had traded Hilton, and obviously I didn't have any inside information on it. I was just told by him, you know, hey, this is a stock that a couple people at our firm are acquiring, hearing something good might happen to it, but there was no real detail. Again, we get those types of tips on a trading desk, you know, dozens of times a week. So I bought that stock, and you know, that's what I thought they were there for, but it turned out to be a different stock altogether.
This is surreal. And I have to ask, because I really don't know anything about the procedure, but what does a German Shepherd dog have to do running around when there's something like a securities fraud, and that's what you're being looked at? Do they suspect drugs, contraband, weapons, or something else?
Well, that was the joke I made, at least in the book. I didn't make it to anybody's face at the time, was, you know, what are you looking for, the securities? It's obviously there to intimidate, and that's the primary purpose. And perhaps if they find drugs too, then they can throw that into the case against you and have some additional leverage to use in negotiations, plea negotiations. But for the most part, it's an intimidating tactic more than anything else. And again, the entire procedure was highly unnecessary. I mean, they could have, you know, what bothered me about it, and I know we're skipping ahead to sort of, you know, some of the ending before we get to the beginning, is had they just told me, I went through this entire procedure, which ended up being about 2 years on pretrial, a sort of ridiculous trial, and then another year and a half or so in prison, 3 years probation. So it turned into like a 7 or an 8 year stretch. And all of that was done for the most part, especially in the beginning, without anybody asking me a single question up front. So had they just asked me, you know, in the beginning, hey, we think you're involved in conspiracy, we'd like to speak to you, of course I would have showed up, you know, whether it was the SEC or the Justice Department, answered questions. That would have been a preferable alternative than a pre-dawn raid in SWAT jackets and, you know, highly armed and drug dogs running around with, you know, I had 3 young kids sleeping upstairs and my wife, who was, you know, obviously a little bit hysterical about the whole situation. So, you know, it was done in a very heavy-handed manner, designed solely to intimidate and really, you know, probably uncalled for, and caused some psychological damage that didn't need to be done. So that was that. That's sort of the procedure sometimes. And that's certainly their right in this type of society to go in like that. But it was done in a very overbearing manner.
That is just outrageous. And this is how it's done today. It's not just, hey, come on down for questioning. Why, they think you're going to run out of town. So they do this to grab someone that's a suspect.
The entire thing was sort of a political play for the most part, just to be very upfront about it. They could have done that. They do it now. You see in some of the Trump investigation, other places, they're not kicking down people's doors and doing pre-dawn raids where kids are involved. And in other cases, I think they got enough criticism about this that they sort of cut back on the procedures that they use. But this was the height of the financial crisis. So you have to remember, this was less about a crime that may have been committed and more about a big time show effort or a deterrence where, you know, law enforcement and the Obama administration, whoever else, could trumpet to a public who was angry about the loss of jobs, the loss of their portfolios, the loss of their houses and house prices, and were pretty pissed off and justifiably so. So this was, I think, a bone that was tossed to them to some degree in order to ameliorate that angry public. And, you know, when you're doing sort of show justice rather than actual justice, you have to sort of make a big show. And that's indeed what they did.
I got you. You were the proverbial head on the pike to quiet things down a little bit.
Sure. I mean, it's a lot easier to go after a guy who, and they charged me, the criminal complaint at the time was for $16,000. So not funny to some degree. If you break the law, obviously, you know, there should be some punishment, but it was relative to what was charged, the way it was handed down and what went down, I thought was a little ridiculous. And it's a lot easier to go after a guy like me who's not politically connected or very well aligned than it is to go after some of the, you know, heads of the big banks or politicians that had bad, you know, intentions and public policies that facilitated this crisis. I mean, the whole insider trading narrative was a very simple and convenient narrative, so to say, that they were able to sell to this angry public rather than doing something about the financial crisis and, you know, the real sort of bad actors and real things that took place. So to do that, though, you'd have to go after some very powerful, very rich people and upend a lot of the swamp that exists, so to speak, in D.C. and on Wall Street. And it's a lot easier to grab a couple of minnows and publicly flog them. I think that was the end result.
I got you completely on that, Michael. And I mean no disrespect by making a little quip and a little joke here. I mean,
no,
they spent more than $16,000 doing all these antics.
Oh, I mean,
it just didn't make, anyways, I get it. I'm hearing this like firsthand, this whole story, and I'm astounded. So there's my natural, authentic reaction.
All good.
And now you went, because for our Revenue Crew audience as well, Michael surpassed this adversity, let's call it, and became extremely successful. And we're going to go into the lessons learned in just a moment. But I have to ask, your business, you couldn't operate your business. So I presume everything crashed down to the bottom during this period, correct?
Yes. I mean, my business was at the time I was running a hedge fund. So we were managing money. And, you know, confidence is a tricky thing in almost any industry. But in finance, it really is the be-all, end-all. So even the appearance of impropriety is enough to be a death sentence to many firms. An FBI SWAT team that arrested me, as well as my other two partners, two of my other partners, and I think there were about nine other people arrested, and then paraded us on CNBC. We were out of business, I think, you know, within 2 minutes of that happening. And by out of business, I mean, you know, our prime broker froze the accounts or sold the accounts. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, the firm was shut and closed that morning, never to open again.
Oh my, that is extremely scary. Just, I can't fathom the anguish that you've been through. And I really appreciate you sharing all this with our Revenue Crew audience. It just blows my mind. I just don't know how else to say it. And I understand you wrote a best-selling book about this and you tell the full story. Can we have the name of that book, please?
Sure. It's Confessions of a Wall Street Insider. There's a subtitle. It's a cautionary tale of rats feds, and banksters. It tells the whole story. And I think if anybody has any interest in either Wall Street or finance, as well as the criminal justice system, I think there are very few books that are written from a first-person narrative that really delves into that and what it was like to be at ground zero during the financial crisis, and also, you know, obviously the epicenter of the largest insider trading investigation in history. So I think everybody will enjoy it who picks it up.
Okay. And may I say, from just the title alone, it sounds like you're confessing to a crime. You're confessing to some wrongdoing.
I'm not confessing to a crime in it. I'm definitely confessing to making some poor choices that put me in a situation where what happened, as I described earlier, was even a possibility. So I don't think I committed a crime. I think the law was clear. I think I got some redemption, although not final legal redemption, in that we had a judge who was a bit of a rogue judge. And after my case, every other insider trading case he got ended up getting overruled because he used the wrong standard and gave incorrect jury instructions. And unfortunately for me, I had already served my time and it was a little too late to protest that. But I do confess to putting myself in a position. I think one of the lessons anybody can learn from my book, my life, or anything else is that ultimately you're responsible for the people you surround yourself with. And, you know, if you choose people who you even have a hunch that they may not be good people and are willing to sort of look the other way or at least not press them on certain things, you know, you can't in the end say, hey, and totally dismiss any of the outcome or consequences that occur from that. And now, you know, I didn't know he was breaking the law or whatnot, but there were other parts of my partner's personality that I thought were at best aggressive and in other ways, just sleazy. You know, again, some of them were personal and not business related, but there were enough things there. You know, had I learned or if I knew what I know today, I have very little tolerance for anybody that gives me any type of feeling, whether it's gut or any other way that I don't sense that I'm dealing with a perfectly honest and good person. You know, I'm in my mid 40s now. I'm not in a position or want to be in a position ever again where I'm not dealing with people that I actually respect and want to be in business with or have in my life around me. So I'm in sort of the shedding part of my life where you have your big basket of friends and colleagues and associates, and you slowly sort of peel the onion until you're with the people who you really want to spend the rest of your day and lives with. And that's okay.
I think that's a great lesson to learn. And some of us may take our connections for granted sometimes or stay connected to some people that maybe we kind of shouldn't. Not that we necessarily need to pry into their affairs, but if information comes up that may not seem like it's the best, I think that's a great lesson. And you've rebound. Now, actually, you were in prison for a year and a half. Is that right?
I was in prison for about a year and a half. 15 months is actually what I ended up serving. And then I did 6 months in a Bronx halfway house. So about 21 months in the Bureau of Prisons.
Okay. The Dream Business community wants to help you with your career and business. As you know, jobs can be fickle. Here today, gone tomorrow. And owning a business has its own frailties. Bloomberg says 8 out of 10 entrepreneurs fail in the first 18 months. A Harvard study says 3 out of every 4 venture-backed firms fail. And there's other sources with shocking figures of their own, which all point to one very conclusive point. These are scary times we live in. Let's help you in the dream business community. Yes, you. Let's try to give you the information you need now to boost your career or business. And I'll be there every step of the way helping you along with other experts in many industries. Are you ready for accelerated success? Check it out, the Dream Business Community at tonydurso.com/community. That's tonydurso.com/community. Is it true that a majority of new businesses fail? Check this out. In order to have a successful growing business, there are some vital points that you must know. You must have worked them out thoroughly. They must be synchronized with each other, and all employees, consultants, and companies that you depend on must know these items and be in agreement with them if your new business is to meet with a high percentage of success. Get it free. The Vision Map. Beat the odds for business success at tonydurso.com/vision. Learn how to establish your vision, purpose, long-term objective, and master plan, including strategic and tactical planning. Get the Vision Map. Beat the odds for business success at tonydurso.com/vision. V-I-S-I-O-N. And we're back with Michael Kimmelman, who tells us how to restart your life and succeed. And now we're going to get to the better part of our interview, let's say, because you rebound. You've become a phenomenal success. So I must ask, was there something in prison or that, halfway house? I'm sorry, what was that?
Halfway house is sort of the readjustment to society portion of prison.
Okay, got it. Was there something there that helped you prepare and plan for the success that you have now?
Not in the halfway house. And that's a whole different story. I mean, halfway houses are a frightening place in some ways and do almost the opposite of what they're intended to do. But that's better discussed on a different show, I think. But in prison, yes. As strange as it sounds, it was a blessing in many ways. It gave me a chance to step back, think about my life, get some humility that was lacking before, to get some perspective and really be grateful for all the blessings I had. I mean, I was almost that cliche of, I had a lot of money. I had sold a piece of my firm for a very large number. So I had enough money more or less for the rest of my life if I wanted to. I lived in a big house. I had an attractive wife. I had, good kids and everything else. And I was miserable. I would wake up, didn't enjoy what I was doing by the end of it, didn't enjoy the people that were around me, partnership, and was drinking too much. I should have sort of aligned myself or taken a step back, but it's sometimes very difficult to do that when we're in the midst of our lives, when we're, at a successful job, when a lot of people and jobs, you're responsible for. It's not always easy to take that step back and say, you know what, this is not what I was put here for. It's not what I enjoy. So why am I doing it? And sometimes if you avoid those difficult conversations with yourself, and I avoided them. I was actually not in a very good marriage and not happy with myself and many other things, but I would just drown those anxieties or doubts with alcohol. And so, and I was highly functioning. I mean, I was running, tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars and building a very successful firm and whatnot. But I was still operating in about a 40 or 50% capacity. And then that's something, had I not had this radical readjustment brought on by external factors, I would have taken to my deathbed probably. And who knows what would have happened. So, whether it's God or something else, when you're not doing the things you're supposed to be doing sometimes, sometimes that entity comes along and wakes you up in a very, very severe fashion. I think if people can get through to the other side from whatever trauma they have to go through, I mean, I think everybody has their demons. If you can make it out, there were a lot of blessings. So, I got sober while I was away. I got clean and clear and started really thinking about what I wanted to do with my life, started appreciating that I had three healthy children that, many people don't or can't conceive or have other issues or have their own health problems. And, I had a lot of things that I had been gifted with and weren't using those to the best of my ability. So prison's a horrible place. It really is a hell. And I don't think the American people would allow it to exist in the manner that it exists today if they really understood it or saw what it was like. But it's almost like, at least for me, and luckily my sentence was something that was doable. Once you do that year and a half of hell, when you get out, your life is immeasurably better if you take the time to learn the lessons of why you were there and appreciate what you actually have. So, now I just feel everything is very fortunate to have. And little things, again, make me happy. I'm not materialistic like I once was. And I appreciate, whether it's a friend smiling at me or the ability to be able to pick up my kids from and watch them play sports or anything else. Like, life is good. You have to take that perspective and see. And sometimes until you've seen how bad it can be, sometimes we don't appreciate how good it can be. So, you know, if there's anything I can tell people is it can get pretty bad, but, you know, we have a tremendous capacity also as people to be able to deal with that adversity. So on the other side, it's good to have that humility and gratitude and perspective. If you can have any three traits and work on any, I'd say those are it.
Thank you very much for sharing that, Michael. I totally feel with you on that, and I totally see that as well from your perspective. And my wife does periodically, she's called to do a transport where a prisoner in the jail is involved. And just hearing some of the stories of how she has to interface with them and what goes on in there is so damn frightening. That alone is very humbling. Just like, just keep me far away from that sort of side of life, you know. I totally, totally see that. Now, during this prison time and travail, I understand the introspection and how you've looked at things. Did you work out or come up with a business methodology or opportunities? Did they start arising then? Can you kind of paint the picture now from there to the post-success that you have, please?
Sure. They did. In prison, you want to try not to get too excited or try to do too much while you're there in some ways, because it can be very frustrating. You're not allowed to conduct business in prison. So, you know, even a phone call to a friend asking for, you know, some articles or whatnot can get you in trouble in those ways. You know, I offered to teach while I was there. I was already tutoring inmates for their GEDs. That's one of the approved jobs. But, you know, I wanted to teach like an interview and a job skills course because there were a lot of people there who had never gone on a job interview or had been away for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. And imagine coming out into a society where cell phones and computers didn't exist, you know, before then, and have to be thrown on the street and deal with that. So simple things like that that would make readjustment easier and be somewhat rehabilitative. I was just blown away by, you know, how they weren't willing to offer that or even allow someone like me who wanted to do it, you know, and not charge anybody for it, just do it. They just didn't want people to do it. It's almost, there's no logic behind it. It's sort of sad and overly punitive, to put it that way. But what I did do is I read a ton, and I thought, again, in our society that, especially now, I mean, it's so much more pronounced. Everybody's glued to their phone and looking down, and there's, you know, an ADD 450 external inputs per minute, you know, firing at us. In that place, you're not watching TV, you're not on your phone, you're walking a track or you're sitting, you know, in your bunk or doing something else. So you had time to really think. And I started writing. So, you know, I'd always been a good writer. I ended up writing about 800 pages of this book, which I trimmed down, fortunately, to about 250, because I don't even think I want to read 800 pages about me or prison or anything else. But I also wrote, you know, a sitcom that I ended up selling. I developed a television show that I got a co-development for, a deal for when I got out. And I started studying real estate again. When I was a lawyer, I did some M&A and some real estate deals, and knew I was a somewhat realist, that I knew I wasn't going to come out and work for Goldman Sachs or go work for a law firm or go work, you know, anywhere in organized, traditional S&P 500 type company, because, you know, in our society, again, it's a black mark, a felony mark, or formerly incarcerated, and you're banned from, you know, besides employment, more or less, from a lot of housing and a lot of credit and other opportunities. So I was very realistic about what I could or couldn't do. And I knew that real estate investment was something I was decent at, and I'd be able to find a partner because, you know, they took all my money. I'd be able to find a partner. And as long as you can add value or knowledge or have a skill, you know, capital is the easiest thing to find. I think these days it's the skill and the knowledge that's hard, as well as the work ethic and somebody who's willing to do the, you know, the hard work in order to make something happen. So I came out and then started doing real estate investment and started just buying up properties, fixing them, and then mechanized that process to some degree and did it nationwide and automated quite a bit of it, doing some house flips. Remember, this was like 2013, so the real estate market was still coming out of the dumps and there were some good bargains around, and, you know, basically lent my expertise there and made a business out of it, and, you know, close several hundred homes in the next 2 or 3 years on that process. And that gave me the capital and some of the time to start experimenting with some other aspects. So, you know, on the consulting front, I got active in the cannabis space and in the CBD space for companies that were producing mostly in the therapeutic space in Colorado where it was legal, and lent my expertise there on a consultant basis. And then also, you know, started studying cryptocurrency and some other things out there. And basically between entertainment, real estate, and the crypto, you know, have been able to rebuild on several fronts.
That's absolutely astounding. What you've done in real estate in just a couple of years is astounding. Most people, that is something that they wish to ascend to through a decade or more, and you did that in just a couple of years. That's quite something. There was a new venture that you started that you wanted to tell me about. What is that, please?
A good friend of mine by the name of Charlie Schrem, and he's sort of a big deal in the cryptocurrency community. Charlie was one of the first people. He founded the Bitcoin Foundation back in 2010, very active in that community, and went through his own travails. But Charlie and I have been sort of kindred spirits, both went through a very similar experience. And we got together in 2014 and became fast friends and, you know, stayed friendly. And Charlie has always been extremely active in the crypto space. And in 2015 or so, I started joining him and doing some advisory work and studying and writing and, you know, doing some investing on that front. And recently in 2017, earlier this year, we sort of formalized that arrangement and, you know, now have an advisory firm and a financial newsletter that we're rolling out. It's actually more of a educational publishing arm, but there is a newsletter component to it. We do a lot of speaking conferences and whatnot, but we're rolling out the newsletter this week or next. So it should be something that, you know, anybody who has been either caught by surprise or is curious about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, but feel that, you know, it's perfect for people who are 15 to 21 who have some technological savvy. But I think a lot of the people who are in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you know, who are very curious about it, but just don't know how to approach it, we're hoping to, you know, basically do something where we can empower these people to understand it, to learn about it, to utilize it, and hopefully to make some money investing in it as well, because it's really, truly a disruptive paradigm that we haven't seen in a very long time.
Very, very needed, Michael. Where were you 5 years ago? I'm teasing. I owned some Bitcoin and I got so frustrated on a regular basis trying to trade it, trying to move it, trying to do anything that I finally decided it was taking so much attention. I just got rid of all my Bitcoin. I just couldn't deal with it. It was just only the super techies were able to know how to manipulate or move it. So the fact that you have a newsletter, and I know it's gotten more organized since, but the fact that you have a newsletter and you're training people and teaching people how to go through it, very, very needed and very, very cool that you're doing that. Is that your main business now, or are you still doing your real estate?
It is. The crypto space is where we're most active. And again, it's obviously blown up a little bit in the last 6 months. So there are a lot of different firms seeking our advice, whether it's on the ICO front or whether it's on the investment front or just, you know, from a tech perspective, to be able to go out and speak about it and evangelize a little bit, but also, like you said, to be able to teach people and empower them to use it in their day-to-day lives and to learn about it, because it is intimidating. And I know it was much more intimidating probably back when you were doing it, but it's still not easy. So without somebody, you know, a mentor or a guide to not always hold your hand, but at least break it down for you in simple terms and explain some of the processes and how your life can be improved by understanding these things, I think that was sorely missing in the business, and hopefully we fill that void.
Very cool, very cool, and very appreciative that you're doing that. And now we're pretty much running out here, and I'd like to know, to encapsulate perhaps the advice and the information, the hard-won experience that you have, is there anything that you can share with our Revenue Crew audience, or perhaps put things more succinctly for them to help them with their businesses and career?
Sure. I think I'm going to end with a broader point, less on the business side. And that's more that fear is such a corrosive, debilitating feeling that everybody has, I think. And, you know, what I went through is something a lot of people, you know, in their minds worry about, and I'm not just talking about prison, it could be, you know, a sickness or divorce or bankruptcy or something else. I think I checked all the boxes on that. But either way, in the end, it's really not as bad as it seems. Like, in our minds, we make almost everything worse than it actually is. And as someone who went, you know, from a decent perch all the way to the bottom and stayed there for a while, the bottom was horrible, but it also wasn't that bad. And the lessons you learn there are something that's valuable. Now, I don't want anybody to have to go through the bottom to learn those lessons. So I would just tell you, a lot of it is just pausing and really thinking things through and taking the time to appreciate that you really probably, as bad as you think your life may be, or as, you know, as anxious as you are about the future, whether it's from an economic or other perspective, we all have tremendous gifts. And if you really take the time to figure out what you have, whether it's your health, whether it's your children, whether it's intelligence, whether it's that we're living in a time now where you literally have the entire compendium of world knowledge at your fingertips. I mean, think about where we were just 25 or 30 years ago. If you wanted to start a business, you know, you had to spend millions of dollars to start that business. Now we have this share economy and everything's rentable and pretty cheap if you think about it, where you can get computing power. I mean, you used to spend millions of dollars on servers and hardware and everything else. Now you can just rent that stuff from Amazon. Whether it's a gig economy and renting talent, you can rent or share almost anything and get a business off the ground today for a thousandth of the price, you know, that we used to be able to. So you don't always have to leave a job or jump off a cliff and hope you can, you know, build an airplane on the way down. A lot of the things you can do today, you can beta it and trial it from your current position, your current job. I mean, you know, everybody can wake up a half hour earlier or go to bed a half hour, 45 minutes later and start trying something if they have a side business or a side hustle or something else they're excited about. And it doesn't always have to be something that makes you money. It could be something that just gives you pleasure or joy because, you know, wealth isn't just about money, obviously. It's about having an impact somewhere and enjoying, you know, the fruits of your labors and being able to be positive and help other people. So take the time to sort of appreciate what you have because perspective and gratitude go a long way, probably farther than almost anything else.
Thank you so much, Michael, for sharing that very deep, very profound, very realistic and down-to-earth, very great advice, very appreciative. Thank you so much for sharing all that, Michael. I truly appreciate you taking the time to spend and share your experience and the wisdom and what you've learned from it, as trying as it could be. Very cool. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tony. Really appreciate you having me. Enjoyed being here.
Absolutely. Once again, this is Michael Kimmelman, and we talked about how to restart your life and succeed. And again, his website is michaelkimmelman.com. And again, that is Michael, KIMMELMAN.com. Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone. And stay tuned to our next show on Revenue Chat. If you like this interview with Michael, would you kindly give me a review on iTunes? A couple sentences is just fine. Thanks in advance. And our next episode is with Julie Broad, using books to build your business. Julie Broad, also known as the Book Broad, is an Amazon overall number one best-selling author, an International Book Award winner, and recipient of the Beverly Hills Book Award for Best Sales Book. As an entrepreneur and successful real estate investor, she was also awarded the Top 20 Under 40 Award. Her latest venture, Book Launchers, helps entrepreneurs and professionals build their brand and boost their business by writing, publishing, and selling a top quality book. Julie talks about using books to build your business on the next episode of Revenue Chat. All right. Thanks again, everyone. And until next time, remember, you can make life better for yourself and everyone. Choose wisely.